The Gladiator.
Okay, good evening, good evening. Back to you. This is The Gladiator. Back with the very, very, very interesting story. This story has a lot of history. And our special guest today is going to be retired DEA agent Gerald Chapman. And Gerald is one of the people that I attended the NABMA conference, and I've always had heard a lot about his history. And I'm glad to know him, and I'm glad I'm part of an agency that he was also part of. But without further ado, I just want to introduce Gerald Chapman to you. And Gerald, would you go ahead on and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, thank you very much, Abe, for this, and thank you for the opportunity. Good evening to the audience. As Abe said, my name is Gerald Chapman, and I'm a retired DEA agent, special agent, and I'm from one of the old schools here. I was recruited and came on the job in 1969. So, but there's a lot of history behind that. Prior to that, grew up in Montgomery, Alabama. I was baptized by the Reverend Dr. Ralph David Abernathy and Martin Luther King Jr. So I grew up in an era during the height of the civil rights movement. And if you know anything about the 1960s, 1950s and 60s, and especially in the South, in Montgomery, Alabama, where I grew up, in Birmingham, the civil rights movement was very, very contentious. I was thought about as a young man what I would do. And since I went into law enforcement, I can tell you right now that law enforcement was not anywhere in my vocabulary or agenda during those early years. You find a lot of kids now that grow up and at 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, they can tell you exactly what they want to do and what they want to be. Being a Black law enforcement officer was nowhere on the radar for most of the Black people in the South that I know about. So it's very interesting and odd how I became a special agent with the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Okay, so Gerald.
Yeah.
You said you grew up in Montgomery, Alabama?
I did.
And say like when you was young, because those years was probably like in what, the early 60s or the late 50s or what? How was it? And what kind of issues did you probably have just growing up? Was it generally like, because that's the South. And the South was a whole lot different then and than it is now, I would say.
It really is. And you put it in a little bit of perspective. We all know about the Emmett Till murders over in Mississippi. Well, he was only 14 years old when that happened. And my parents were, my mother and father were well-educated. And of course, I was about 7 years old when Emmett Till was killed. And mm-hmm. being right next door, Alabama being right next door to Mississippi, and growing up in the Jim Crow law area, one of my mother's harshest fears were nightmares was that I would get taken by some people who affiliated themselves with the Ku Klux Klan. The tensions between Black and white, you're talking about really segregation. That was during eras where you, as a boy growing up, you had, you know, colored drinking fountain, whites only. You can't go in this, you can't go in that. So even in the movie theaters, If you wanted to go to the theater, you would have to, if they let you in, you would have to go upstairs and sit in the bathroom. You could not sit in. You pay at the outside, at the booth. You walk between an alley and go up some stairs and get onto the raft and watch the movie and come out. So,
So one question you said Emmett Till was killing. Do you know what year that was?
That was in 1956. 55, 56. Yes.
Damn. Okay. Oh man, that's interesting. So you remember all that? I'm sure you do, because you don't forget stuff like that. And yeah, you just don't. Oh. You don't forget stuff like that, because it could happen to you.
Well, you're absolutely right. And you know, your parents knew what was going on. They knew what time of day it was then. Mm-hmm. And hey, especially my mother was very, very tough on us. And I could not go out the front yard. I couldn't step off the curb. If I was out of her whistling sight, when she said, come in, that was it. And, you know, back then, most days, kids played outside. That's all you had to do. You played out in the yard, out in the street. But my mother was kept an eye on us. And that's a whole different, another topic to talk about, you know, my mother and how she felt. But we knew all those things happened. And we knew that her concern, her nightmares, her fears, any mother or parent would certainly have nightmares about how things, their kids being safe and sound. At the same time, not only that, when the bus boycott started in 1955 as well, I was only 9 years old. And of course I knew that. And again, the reason my affiliation with Dr. King and Ralph Abernathy, you know, I was a Southern Baptist. My mother went to church there. And so we knew and all the things that were going on. We knew part of the plan, even at that particular age. You really kind of grow up pretty fast. You learn a lot by listening to the older people. They tried to teach you how to stay out of trouble. It's almost like now we have to teach our young men, black men, how to stay safe when they have an encounter with the police.
Yeah.
So it was one of those kind of things.
So, did you ever run into any problems, any significant problem that just stand out, you know, while growing up and just going about your daily business? Was there ever any issues like that?
Well, yes, I think, you know, you and I had talked before, and and because that was a civil rights era and moving up, trying to and doing demonstrations. Now, my first encounter or arrest by the police in Montgomery, Alabama at about 13 years old was when we lived in a place outside the city limits, but it was still Montgomery County. Yeah. And two of my neighbors, young men like me, 12, 13 years old, would walk down the highway to a corner store just to get a stick of candy or pop or whatever it is. And between this, where we lived and the store we were going to, it was probably about a mile, but then on both sides there were cotton fields. And I have gone out during the summer sometimes and tried to pick cotton just to pick up a few pennies. That's all it was worth.
Okay, I can stop you there, because I guess picking cotton made you realize that was for you.
Oh, absolutely. I knew right then that, hey, I could not make a living doing that. So, and again, you know, as I mentioned, my parents were educated, and my mother and father were divorced when I was an early age. So, but my mother drilled into us the value of being educated and getting educated. So, but she also encouraged us to not only listen to what she's saying, but if we try things and we can learn some from experience, and just to show us, that was an encouragement. Hey, no, there's no way that I can get out there in that hot sun and all day long and drag a bag of cotton. And maybe at that point, I think they were paying 1 or 2 cents a pound, but cotton was really light, man. So it takes a lot of to fill a bag up.
Yeah, and myself, I also picked cotton, you know, around, I'm gonna remember 4, 5, and 6 years old, up until I got to about 7. But this was like in the early 60s. I remember that.
Yeah.
But I didn't mean to get you off the story. I just want to emphasize that I think picking cotton made a lot of us realize that ain't what we wanted to do, and I realized that too. So go ahead on, talk about the point when you was walking from the store with your neighbors.
Right, we were just walking down the street, and nice Friday afternoon, and so this long highway, it's just cars would come up and down. Because it wasn't in the city, you know, cars and trucks would pass by once in a while you're walking. So as we were walking, a truck came up, they had some kids, white kids on the back of it, and when they saw us, at first the truck tried to run us over because we had no sidewalks. We were walking on the edge of the road. And then they threw rocks and bricks and all kind of stuff. And we had to run out through the cotton field and try to hide while they turn around and come back and do the same thing as we come back up on the highway to try to continue our journey to the store. So we decided, there's 3 of us, and we said, hey, look, we got to get ready. We got to protect ourselves. And we found rocks and bottles and stuff, and as they came back, we returned the those bottles and rocks back to them.
Yeah.
So they turned around a couple of times, and then I guess they went on. We actually hit the truck with a brick or a rock or something. I don't know whether the window was broken or not, but somehow they must have come across a police officer who, you know, just kind of cruised down the highway, just kind of around the place. And they must have told them what had happened. So they came back. We saw the cops come up, one car, pulled us over to stop the car and told us to stay where we were. We'll know who we were, what we were doing. And he got on the radio and called a couple more cops. And next thing you know, man, we were dragged off. We had to pass our home. And we told them what happened, but they put us in the car and took us downtown.
Yeah.
Now, we had to spend the weekend in jail at 12, 13 years old because we were trying to protect ourselves. They called, I guess, our parents and told them that where we were, but they couldn't come get us because the jail was closing on Friday evening. So we spent Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday night in jail. So that was my first encounter.
Was that the Munn County, Alabama jail?
Montgomery, Alabama. They had a Montgomery County, a Montgomery Police Department. And they kind of ruled, it wasn't the sheriff's office, but, I'm not sure how those police departments were set up then, but I knew it was Montgomery. And it wasn't in the county that they took us back downtown to the city jail. So, you know, now law enforcement is broken up into, you have your city and then you have your county.
Yeah.
The sheriff's department and so forth. Obviously, I didn't know how police departments were run back in those days. So, but it was a city, and that was my first encounter. And my mother, I can imagine I know after they came down on Monday and picked us up, and but I can imagine after her talking to me, telling me how she couldn't sleep, and she worried about me, and I should never do that, and it was one of those kind of things, and I got to stay away from, that was one of the things that she was really, really afraid of.
Right, okay. But y'all did end up getting out of there, and did they was there any repercussions of that? Did you have to pay a fine? Or?
Well, you know, again, I really don't know too much more of the detail. I think that I don't remember her. She had to pay any money. I would have known that because I probably never would have heard the last of that. And I probably had to pay for it. I probably have to pay for it otherwise, too. But I think it was more of a frightening thing. And she was probably more frightened than I was. I guess I was too young to know what really could have happened to us in that jail.
Yeah. What could have happened.
Yeah, what could have happened. And so I think that was...
And that was after Emmett Till.
That was after... That was after Emmett Till. Remember that when Emmett Till got killed, man, that was, at that point, I was like almost in, actually, I was a little bit early on, and I was either in almost ready to go to high school when that happened to me, because I was able to graduate from high school at age 16. So,
okay.
So,
yeah, that's kind of young.
That was much later, yeah.
Okay, so moving forward, where did you attend college at and all of that? And what did you major in?
Well, I attended Alabama State and also at Tuskegee. I also attended the Alabama State Laboratory High School, which is a campus school for the college. It's like a prep school, like you have now, a prep school, where schools are attached to colleges and stuff like that.
So you attended two historical black colleges, Alabama State and Tuskegee, Alabama.
Yep, and hey, that was the only thing that was available. Segregated schools, integrated schools. I mean, the University of Alabama was not even integrated at that particular point in time.
Right.
And I do remember the stories of Vivian Malone and the people who tried to integrate University of Alabama, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Did you know any of them?
No, I did not know any of those people at the time because they were from a different part of the, I think, part of the state.
Okay. Okay, so you attended both HBCUs. Which one did you graduate from, one of them, or did you graduate from both of them?
I graduated from Alabama State University. Yeah.
Okay, and that's in Montgomery.
Montgomery, Alabama. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what did you major in while you was there?
Well, I majored in chemistry and math. So I was a more like a science person, physical sciences.
And you end up with DEA.
And I ended up with DEA. And that was strange too, because at the time that I was, after I graduated, I went to work for the Department of Defense, Aeronautical Chart and Information Center. It's kind of like the Army Map Service that was during the Vietnam crisis, where we provided aerial mapping for the pilots to use during the bombing missions at that time. But I went from there to, and again, that was part of my service from the military.
Okay, so instead of going in, so that was like military duty?
It was. They, right, exactly.
I bet your parents were happy about that, boy.
Well, yeah. Well, there was something that, and let me, well, I'm sure they were. Now, there are a lot of things that happened to me before that. My mother passed at the end of my freshman year of college. And I'm sure she would have been really, really proud. But the thing that saved me were some of the professors at school and a couple of friends who, families who kind of helped guide me. But I had a sister that was 3 years younger than me that I had to help take care of as well. And she did very well. She was much smarter than I was, but she did well. So we got over that. But I'm sure my mother at some point in time looked down, and that's a part of my history here, is because there are a lot of things that I learned, and I'm saying I had to grow up real fast, that kind of put me in a different trajectory to try to make something out of my life and be somebody.
Right.
So
when you like you said, you was working for the Department of Defense, and that was, you know, you didn't have to. So did they draft you for that? Did you just sign up, or how did it go?
Well, what happened was, you know, during that time, we did have a selective service system. They were drafting. I did get drafted when I was in college, but I was able to go from 1A to 1F while I was in college. And that was a situation where once I graduated, I had to do service time. And at that particular point in time, because the war was going on, I had no other brothers or other male. I was able to do my duty under the DOD as a cartographer, but I had to go back to school. It was like going into basic training and then going to your advanced training. But because I had the chemistry and math and science background, they thought that I would be better suited to help in the air charting division. So,
okay, that's good. That's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. But I know you probably knew people went to Vietnam and didn't come back.
I do. I have very good friends. As a matter of fact, one of the families that kind of helped take care of me was a large family. They had 8 children. The oldest son also went to Tuskegee. He was a pilot, and he was killed in Vietnam as they were trying to make it back from delivering. He was flying the C-5A, the transport planes, at the time. So, I know a lot of college guys that went to Vietnam and never returned as well.
Okay, so you did the DOD thing. So what kind of happened? What kind of transpired? Did you ever wanted to what did you want to, after that, what field did you want to go into after that?
Well, actually, when my service time was up, I could have stayed on with ACIC, Aeronautical Chart and Information Center, because again, and what that is now, it's actually the Geospatial Center now. It changed
name.
So, but I went to work because of my background in chemistry and math. I went to work for the HHS, Health and Human Services. It used to be HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, as a chemist. And I started working on my master's degree in chemistry, organic chemistry, at Emory University. So while I was there, that's when the opportunity came up, when BNDD, Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, started to recruit for African-Americans.
You need to say that one more time, because people know a DEA. A whole lot of people don't know a BNDD. Explain that just a little further.
Well, the BNDD, was actually, the forerunner of DEA. It's a predecessor, same agency, but is the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. And it's really kind of interesting because recently, you know, the Billie Holiday film came out, and we were talking about the forerunner of the administrator at that time, Anslinger. And it was interesting that even DEA wasn't mentioned in that as then, because they had to look at it as the FBN. So before even the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, it was the FBN, and they were under the Treasury Department at one time.
And so that was the Federal Bureau of Narcotics.
Yep. So there's a, yep, that was the Federal Bureau of Narcotics.
And so, it sounds like they kind of named them because of the FBI.
Well, and, that's what it was before DEA. And so I think that was a reorganization. And of course, they were under, from my history, they were under the Treasury Department at that time. And so when BNDD came in, they were put under the Justice Department. And so that's where I came in. And I was recruited by legendary Art Lewis and Clarence Cook. They were on a run to try to encourage African-American people to join the Bureau. So as a chemist and during that time, 1969, 1970, I think that Art Lewis and Clarence Cook probably brought on 90% of the African-Americans that that came on the job at that time.
So, right, and these were two black narcotics agents for the BNDD at that time.
That is correct. That is
correct. And they must have realized that the Bureau just made sense to have more. It did. They was actually trying to help the agency out,
absolutely,
in a way.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the drugs were ramping pretty bad back in those days. They had the Iran-Contra affair, and of course they had some of the people. They thought that drugs, I guess they thought that drugs were more prevalent in the black neighborhoods, and that we were distributing and all that. And actually, in order to clean up, I guess they thought that they could not infiltrate properly the drugs in a black neighborhood. So, hey, that's just the way it was. They just came out and tried to recruit people, but they were very, very selective about who they did recruit. I mean, I came onto the job and found out there were people who were already on the job. Some didn't have degrees and that kind of thing. So,
oh, okay, yeah, because you got a master's, right?
Yes, I do.
I mean, had a master's when you came on the job.
I got my master's. I was working on a master's before I came on the job, but I completed my master's in criminal justice, which was a different field, after I was on the job.
And what city did you start in when you was being recruited? Where were you at, and what did you end up starting at?
Well, I was recruited. I was working in Atlanta, so I was recruited in Atlanta. But when I came out of training, my first assignment was in Miami Field Division.
Oh, I bet that was interesting at the time.
Well,
you was living in Atlanta then?
Yes, I was. I was living in Atlanta.
Okay, going from Atlanta to Miami. That was an interesting time. Well, then what was the prevalent drug at that time?
Well, the prevalent drug at that time was heroin. They were concerned more about the heroin. Cocaine was very prevalent on the scene. But at that time, DEA had a strategy of Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, and had a strategy, a national strategy, because heroin was supposed to have been more dangerous. And so there was the national strategy to recruit. And it is interesting because it appeared that when we came on the job for the black agents, that we were supposed to, at least the office I came on in Atlanta back in those days. And I had to be there for a while because, we had to wait for transfer monies and stuff like that. So I was really worked back in Atlanta for almost a year before I was transferred, but I was assigned to the Miami Field Division. Now, the back in those days, we used to have what we called the big regions, and Miami regional office also covered Atlanta at the time. It wasn't the Atlanta Field Division by itself. It was all right. Called the Atlanta District office. So a lot of geographical changes that we have now with the field division. We have probably more than 20 field divisions right now. But back then, we only had maybe five or six or something like that, you know, that covered right, a lot more area.
Yeah, DEA is broken down a lot more, a whole lot more with a whole lot of people. Do you remember how many agents, when you got hired on, do you remember how many agents DEA had and how many black agents they had? Because I know the majority of agents at that time were white agents and all that. Do you remember that?
Yes. Well, I have a general idea. I think roughly around that time, we had somewhere maybe around 500 agents total. But from my understanding, what I was told, I was never really checked this out at that time, that I was probably somewhere around the 69th. We had about 69 black agents throughout the Bureau at that time.
Throughout the country?
Yep, throughout the country. And maybe if there were a couple overseas at the time. So it was it has grown a lot. But the numbers, so we were less than 10% of the number of agents that they had.
Okay, so, and I may have missed something. When you graduated from BNDD, mm-hmm. you was in a class, so there was no DEA classes because the DEA as an agency had not been created yet. Right?
DEA had not been created yet. I came in on BNDD class 7. There were two black agents. That was myself and Richard Jacob.
And who was that?
Richard Jacob. He was he had been a New Orleans police officer before he came on the job. The classes before me, and they were running about 2 weeks apart at that time. Class 6, I think they had probably six or more people. That was the class that Benny Swin, Art Carter, and Charlie Brown, and John Hughes, and those people were in. So but we were all around the same time because when a class started, 2 weeks later, they started another class. So they were really trying to do a lot of recruiting back in those days.
So when DEA was formed, what was you at and what you remember about that?
When DEA was formed, it was 1973, right between DEA and BNDD was BDAC, the Bureau of Drug Abuse Control. It was only lasted for a few months until they can reorganize to DEA. And, but I had been in Miami, and then at that point in time, I was back in Atlanta.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you was in Miami, and I know a lot of guys that spent time in Miami. And one of the guys that instrumental with me being on this job was Calvin Campbell. And I knew he was in Miami quite a bit. And I give up my hats off to him because he's one of the reasons that I ended up on the job.
Well, that's interesting because Calvin Campbell was besides he is also a founding member, a co-founding member for NAPN.
Okay.
Calvin and I, and if we go back to Miami days, there were several of us. Calvin Campbell was there when I arrived in Miami. I learned about him. He kind of was the senior of all the blacks that were there, and there were only about four or five of us there. And he kind of took us under the wing and showed us, and I knew a lot about him. came over from the U.S. Postal Service before he came on the job. I think that Calvin had a lot to do with the maturity of a lot of the young agents that came on the job during that time.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why, one of those is the reason why NABNA was formed, is because if you can imagine, now the agency is becoming more integrated. We still had people on the job that were probably not too pleased to see us come on the job.
Right.
And for an example, when I came on the job and I was hired and finished and came out and came back to Atlanta and had to be there a while, office spaces was very small. They had to kind of put people in the offices together. Yeah. But I had was put into an office with a white guy. And so the other white guys would come around, they could walk into the office and they wouldn't even acknowledge that I was there. I mean, they would come in and they'd talk about whatever they wanted to talk about. I'm sitting at one desk, my partner, supposedly being the senior partner, is sitting at another desk, and they'd make plans to go out for lunch to eat, and the other guy would walk in and walk out the door wouldn't even say one word. But there were times when, the black agents kind of like football, and especially the old historic college gridiron play.
Right.
Calvin went to Tennessee State. We had people who went to Florida A&M, and that was one of the first classic football games that people got together. Now, all the agents who used to get together were from different divisions, Washington Field Division, Miami, Atlanta, and we just make plans and try to get together and go to one of those games so we can kind of communicate with each other. You know, we felt isolated in offices. We felt a lot of times that we were doing work and weren't being covered properly, and when something happened, you know, this is a dangerous job. There's nothing that you had to rely on your safety by the people you work with.
And I got you. So you mentioned NABNA, and I know what NABNA is, as I've been a member of NABNA. And will you kind of explain NABNA and why y'all decided to create NABNA? And also, one of the reasons why I made it on this job was because I did attend TSU also, Tennessee State. And Calvin Campbell found that out, because I had applied. And he called me, and I was in Memphis at the time, police officer. And he said, "I got to see your application there. And you went to TSU and you played football." And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, and it's his words, and he passed now. He said, "You need to bring your ass down and see me right now." That's what he said. And that's what happened. Well, anyway, kind of hit on the NABNA thing and why it was founded, and what was one of the reasons. And I know it had a lot to do with undercover work. While a lot of black guys was recruited on DEA and promotions and all of that.
Well, all right. There are a couple of things that you sounded just like Calvin would talk to us too. He was more like what we call the old man, but you can't be an old man on this job. But and I say old man, he had more maturity than we had. It started NABNA, the National Association of Black Narcotic Agents, because over a period of 4 or 5 years, we would get together. There were a lot of issues going on in different offices. Like the one I just told you, we had problems in either getting promoted. We were all doing the same work. When it came up to training and selections for special jobs, blacks were not particularly given the opportunity, nor were they selected. So this really prohibited your advancement when you don't only, when you're going to be a single expert on doing undercover work. But we also know that at some point in time, you know, you can't be out there on the street all the time, day in and day out, without increasing your risk of getting injured or killed.
Yeah.
So, true. So the only way that you can move into other jobs, supervisory jobs, other specialty jobs, is that you had to have the training, you had to have the knowledge, you had to have the experience. And when you're not getting that and you put in for a job, you cannot be competitive for everybody else, with whoever else at that time. So a lot of us were separated from each other. In my office, there were basically two people, most of the time, two blacks, period. So I'm talking about these other guys. In some of your larger offices, you may have three or four, but these guys didn't really work together. They worked in separate groups, and we were almost like competing against each other who's going to get promoted. We saw all of that. And as we talked, we found out that we've got to do something to try to increase our awareness, how to increase our education, how to increase our training, how to put together a platform to address some of these issues. And as we talked, we decided that, hey, look, we need to find a way to communicate. It was almost like trying to survive. If you're in an
office, you was trying to survive.
Right, exactly, in more ways than one.
Yeah.
I'm trying to survive when I go out in the street and doing the undercover work, because most times you're going in places and neighborhoods, you know, if a white showed up within two blocks, man, you know, that kind of made an alert for people, because they usually don't come around black neighborhood. And, you know, they didn't need a radio in the black community to know, to communicate. Hey, the word spread pretty quickly, you know, like beating the drums or sending out smoke signals. Well, if anything happened to anybody, any one of us that's in deep in that environment, it would take a long time for somebody to get to us to save us. So,
right.
So we had to be really thinking on our feet, because a lot of times when you get into a situation, you got to kind of improvise along the way. This is not like a movie theater where everybody's got a speech or a screenplay, and you know your words. I know what you're going to say. You know what I'm going to say. It's ad-lib, and you rely on your training and your experience, and you hope that your surveillance people can listen, hear, see, and get there in time before, you know, things get too far out of hand.
Gerald Chapman, and we're going to continue on where we left off with our special guest, Gerald Chapman, and I hope you listen to this story. Please share this podcast. Subscribe, and we're gonna see you next week. The Gladiator signing off.
The Gladiator.